Awesome, like podcasts and stuff?
I've seen people with podcasts less desperate for approval.
I hope this isn't about your podcast again.
Please, podcasts are verbal narcissism for ugly journalists.
Welcome to the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Ben Heisler.
Welcome, everyone, to episode number 41 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. Ben Heisler here with you. As we get set to wrap up the month of July, we have NFL training camp season and fantasy football season, for that matter, starting to get underway. We wanted to talk some football and learn a little bit about one of the biggest newsmakers in the NFL and football industry. So our guest today is Mike Florio. He, of course, is the creator of ProFootballTalk.com. He is the host of PFT Live on NBC Sports Network. And you can also see him every Sunday evening during the NFL season over on Football Night in America on NBC. You know, Mike's got a pretty unique story for those of you that are unfamiliar. He's a West Virginian born, and I believe he currently still lives in West Virginia. He was born there, but grew up a Vikings fan when everybody else around that area was a diehard Steelers fan. He turned a career as a lawyer into then becoming one of the biggest names in NFL coverage and reporting. And his break into the NFL field happened almost on a whim. So we talked about that part of his story, his life growing up, and where that sarcasm and contrarian streak comes from, as well as some of the other major prominent stories in the NFL. And this is a lot of fun. He confirmed something to me about the great Al Michaels that I always believed to be an urban myth, and he actually confirmed it and says it's 100% true. So I'm excited to bring you guys that conversation with Pro Football Talk's Mike Florio. Before we do that, quick reminder to check out all the great work from our team over at awfulannouncing.com. If you are not following us on Twitter, you can do so at awfulannouncing. If you want to follow me, I am at Benny Heiss. Also, please subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcast from. And if you listen over on Apple Podcasts, any and all reviews are certainly appreciated. Love the five-star ones, but if you'd like us to try something a bit differently or you have other feedback, we are always paying attention. So please take a quick moment if you like the show or would like to like the show more. I think that makes sense, and you can help us get better. Very excited to be joined by the creator of ProFootballTalk.com. He's also the host of PFT Live and part of the Football Night in America team on NBC. And make sure you guys are following him on Twitter at ProFootballTalk. But more than likely, if you listen to the Awful Announcing Podcast, he's already probably one of your top follows on the tweet machine. Mike, it's great to talk to you today. I appreciate your time.
Hey, great to be with you. How's everything?
Everything is wonderful. And I want to start by diving into sports media. For many of us, it can sort of tear away a lot of your elements of your original fandom. And I think it was a Rich Sandomir piece in the New York Times from about 10 years or so ago that you grew up a Vikings fan, and this is still growing up in Wheeling, West Virginia. So how did that connection between a West Virginia kid and the Vikings occur? And do you still feel like you can still be a fan as you continue to cover all 32 teams?
I grew up in an area that was staunch Pittsburgh Steelers fans, and you had to be a Pittsburgh Steelers fan. And it's funny because when you live in West Virginia, you hate the University of Pittsburgh. But if you're in the northern part of the state, you like the Pittsburgh professional teams because you don't have your own professional teams to follow. So it's natural to like the Steelers, Pirates, and Penguins, and it's natural to hate the Pitt Panthers. It's just a weird kind of existence. But I have a very strong contrarian streak, so I didn't like being told that I had to be a Steelers fan, and I liked the idea of picking my own team out of the full assortment of NFL franchises, and I liked purple, and I liked the horn on the helmet, even though when I was a little kid, I had no idea that that was supposed to be a horn. It doesn't translate well in two dimensions. They've enhanced it in recent years to put a little shading there so people can figure out what it is, and that was just it. They were on TV. Because back in those days, there weren't many games on. You had to be a great team to be on TV often enough for a little kid to get influenced to follow that team. And it just kind of went from there. And I remember watching Super Bowl VIII. That was the first time I was, like, fully engaged and, you know, pissed off beforehand when the experts were going one after another saying, I think the Dolphins are going to win. Very excited when people would say, I think the Vikings are going to win. And then the game itself sucked. And it was too late for me to go back at that point.
Is it now funny to think about that after being mad at those guys that were picking against your team, you're now one of those guys that has to give an opinion on the set Super Bowl?
Well, and that's why I don't get upset when people get mad at me when I say something about their team and they get pissed off, because I understand it's the passion that draws people to the sport. It's that same passion that causes them to react the way that they react if you say something about their team that they don't like. And and that's why it never bothers me when people get upset that I said something that doesn't proclaim to the world that their team is the best team in the NFL and is destined to win every Super Bowl for the next 10 years.
You mentioned you have a bit of a contrarian streak. Where did that come from?
I really don't know. I probably my mom. My mom did not work out of the house after I was born. She worked before I was born. She didn't go to college, although she was smart enough that she could have. She never had a driver's license, but she did not suffer fools well, and she was not bashful about telling you what she thought. And it kind of comes from that. So, you can't pick your genes. You just have to let the cards play as they've been dealt, and I think that's where it comes from.
Did it ever get you in trouble as a child at all?
Yeah, well, it took me about, I don't know, 3 or 4 years to realize the connection between being a smartass and getting spanked. And then once I realized the connection between being a smartass and getting spanked, I would do the cost-benefit analysis every time. I would think about using that smartass line. Like, I know there's a chance I'm going to get spanked for this, but, you know, what the hell? I'll go ahead and say it anyway.
One of the most important lessons I ever learned as a child was telling my mom after I got punished for something, quote, "Is that the best you got?" And sure enough, it wasn't. And I learned my lesson very quickly.
Yeah, I tried that. Yeah, once I started to get a little older and felt like, you know, I could assert myself, I acted like it didn't hurt. And then I got one that did hurt.
Tell me about growing up in Wheeling. What did you guys do for fun? What were part of your high school days? What was your life like?
Well, you know, those were back in the days when there was only 3 channels on TV. And I remember it was a new universe when WTBS, it used to be WTBS before it was TBS, and they broadcast nationally by, and I don't know how any of this worked at the time, but when the local CBS affiliate would go off the air at 1:30, 2 a.m., they would flip over to WTBS, and they had all the Atlanta Braves games. And back in those days, the Atlanta Braves were in the NL West, and they were constantly playing in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and San Diego. So, you know, for fun, you stay up late on summer nights watching the Atlanta Braves play their West Coast swing every few weeks, which was just underscores how boring life was back in those days. A lot of fishing, a lot of being outside. Like, now I'm at the age where I have to worry about all the moles start popping up on my skin, because back in those days we never wore sunscreen, and they basically threw us out of the house at 8 a.m. in the summertime, let us back in for lunch, threw us back out again, came back for dinner, threw us back out again, and we wanted to be out. Ran around unsupervised, stuff that would get you removed from your parental custody in this day and age. We ran around unsupervised all day in the sun with no sunscreen, sometimes with no shoes on, and, you know, just found stuff to do, and every once in a while found trouble to get into.
You mentioned your love for the Minnesota Vikings as a child and sort of going in that contrarian way and not rooting for the Steelers. But at what point for you did the NFL or football in general become such a passion of yours?
You know, it was kind of on parallel track with baseball as I was growing up. And, you know, I was all in with the Pirates, and that's what was weird about it. I did not like the Steelers, but I did buy into the whole Pirates thing. I didn't start picking different teams in all the various sports. I just did it in football. But I remember being very engaged with the 1979 Pirates that won the World Series. I can remember scouring over the box scores when I was eating Frosted Flakes in the morning when I was in grade school and all the way through high school, and really was a big Pirates fan until 92, the year that they lost in the NLCS to the Braves, when Sid Breen scored from second on the routine single that Barry Bonds should have thrown him out at home and somehow didn't, and the Braves advanced to the World Series. I knew at that point the Pirates were not going to be good again for a very long time. I had no idea how long it would be. And that's kind of where I just quit caring about the Pirates, and I was all in with the NFL. And then once I stumbled into this business in 2000, 2001 timeframe, following other sports became a luxury that I couldn't afford because you spend all your time following football.
You say you stumbled into the business. I would imagine that even though you might have used the word stumbled, it must have been something in your head for a while that said, this is something that I want to do. It was just a matter of moving forward with it. No, you actually stumbled?
What happened was, back in the early days of the internet, I really didn't know much about the internet. All I knew was we had a computer in the house, and it was before flat screen, so you had that monitor. The bigger the monitor, the bigger the screen was, the larger the monitor was. Like, it needed, you know, it was like this big monstrosity that you could have on the desk. And we had the AOL CD that would give you access. You know, it was great for me because the local newspapers typically focus on the Steelers, and I couldn't get news and information about the Vikings. And once that AOL disc came along and I started poking around, Sporting News had a deal with AOL. So Sporting News had an area where you could get updates on every team, and I would check that constantly to see what was going on with the Vikings. Well, I went to lunch one day. This was April of 2000. I had just launched my own law practice. I thought the firm that I'd been a partner at, I just wanted to do my own thing. And I was eating lunch, and I was reading an article in USA Today about a website called NFLTalk.com. It's like, well, I guess there's a lot out there beyond what's on this AOL CD that, you pay $20 a month or whatever it was time for. And so I started going there. It's like, hey, I really like this. And I remember, like, through the draft in 2000, checking that, and I got hooked on it. And this was June of 2000, early June 2000. I checked the website, NFLTalk.com, in the morning, and I saw a little message up at the top. They were looking for writers. And so I threw something together, and I said, what the hell? This is just fun. I could do this. I write all the time. And when you practice law, you write all the time. Nobody ever reads it other than the judge, the opposing lawyer, and maybe your client, if your client cares enough. So, and you're writing all the time. You're generating pages after pages after pages of content. I think I could throw something together and we'll see what they say. And I sent something in, and they called me within a week or so and said, hey, we'd love for you to write for us. And it was unpaid, and they never paid me a cent. I did more and more for them throughout the course of the 2000 season just because I enjoyed it. And your spouse protects you in situations like that where you're potentially being taken advantage of. And she would ask me from time to time, why are you doing this if they're not paying you? It's like, well, I like it. And I have a feeling that this could lead somewhere. I don't know where, but, I like it. It's a hobby. It doesn't cost me anything like golf would. So, I'm just doing this, and we'll see where this goes. And that's how it all got started.
So my understanding of it was, did you ever end up having any sort of ownership stake in NFLTalk.com when it got sold to ESPN?
None. No ownership stake. Never got a dime from them. What happened was, when the tech bubble burst in early 2001, the guys who ran NFLTalk.com and the other companion sites under the SportsTalk.com umbrella, and they paid like $100,000 for the SportsTalk.com domain name when they set the whole thing up. They just decided they were done pouring money down a dry hole. They weren't making any money. They had a significant amount of expenses because they did have paid staff. So they sold, they shut it down, and they sold the carcass to ESPN, which took all of that and put it into their ESPN Insider service. And that's when I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. They needed somebody to produce the daily content, the rumor mill content, for what was NFLTalk.com, what was now the ESPN Insider service on their NFL page. And so it's like, hey, okay, fine, I'll do that. And that was the first time I ever got paid.
Do you ever wonder, Mike, how much different your perspective would have been if you hadn't gone to law school and practiced labor law and instead had gone and covered the league right out of college? Like, you said you stumbled upon this opportunity, but I would imagine in a sense that it allowed you to write for NFL Talk and get your gig started in a sense.
I remember when I first got started in this business, and I knew that there was so much that I did not know about journalism and reporting and the way things work. And you just kind of learn by experience, trial and error, osmosis, et cetera. But I remember feeling horribly inadequate because I didn't have the training in what it takes to, you know, to properly cover a sport or cover anything. And then not that long into it, I remember thinking, my God, I would feel even more inadequate if I didn't have a law degree. I can't imagine with all the legal things that pop up from time to time, having to find someone who can explain it all to me. And I think most of the people who cover the NFL don't do that. Maybe they do some research online, or, you know, maybe they have a friend that they can bounce something off of. But a lot of times they just don't bother. They just repeat the basic nuts and bolts of whatever it is that's going on, and they don't have the perspective to explain what it means. And that's one thing that, even though I haven't practiced law in 10 years, I did it for 18 years, and any of these issues that come up, I've got that extra little twist where I can infuse analysis of the legal aspects into whatever it is that may be going on. And there's always something going on. You know, there aren't as many. I remember there was a rash of criminal trials involving NFL players like Mark Shimura, Ray Lewis, Ray Caruth back 17, 18 years ago. It hasn't been quite like that. That's good for the NFL. But there's still plenty of issues from a legal standpoint that come up all the time.
This might sound like a stupid question, but when you stopped, you said it was 10 years ago. Was that when NBC Sports came along? Was that when you guys partnered up?
Yeah, that was one of the requests that NBC made when we finally worked out a deal. They wanted me to stop practicing law. And I think I acted like I didn't want to stop practicing law. I don't know why I acted like that, because I couldn't wait to stop practicing law. And it was almost, I don't know, it was just a weird, it was a weird feeling to finally, because I'd been looking for that ticket out for so long, and I finally got it. And at first I was like, I really don't want it. And then I realized, no, I'll take it. That's fine. You don't want me to practice law yet. I think I can deal with that.
And now here we are 18 years later. Pro Football Talk has been around the same amount of time that you were practicing law. So it's almost interesting to come full circle on it. And so in those 18 years, as you've watched the growth and the development of the site, is there anything that comes to mind, maybe the first thing that pops in your head of the most important or the most memorable posts or articles that you've worked on and been associated with?
I think the one thing that still stands out more than anything else was when they found that dog fighting operation in rural Virginia that happened to be on property owned by Mike Vick, and the initial accounts and reports were all Vick doesn't know anything about it, and Vick's never there, and it's Vick's family members or cousins or whoever. I remember thinking right at the outset that this is BS. There's no way that this guy doesn't know what's going on, and he's lying about it. And I just remember being very, very aggressive, pushing and pushing and pushing the issue, especially at the time the local prosecutor seemed to be hell-bent on looking the other way. And eventually the local prosecutor, I believe, just deliberately bungled. There were some remaining charges that could have been made against Mike Vick at the state level for animal cruelty that he hadn't been charged with at the federal level, and he didn't even get indicted on those. And it should have been the literal ham sandwich indictment. I mean, he had everything he needed to get an indictment in a matter of seconds. But I always sensed that there was something there, and I kept pushing and pushing, and then it all got validated, vindicated. You know, I felt good about my own instincts, and I feel like a lot of people noticed what we were doing then, and a lot of people started taking this more seriously. And I know there are people in the business, in the media business, who will say that Vick never would have even been arrested or prosecuted or charged if we hadn't pushed it the way we did. I don't believe that, but if people want to think that, then that's their business. But that's the one thing that stands out, because it covered multiple weeks, multiple months in 2007, and we put a lot of time and effort into it, just because I knew from the outset, it had a very strong gut level, that what he was saying just flat out wasn't true.
Also, how much true independence do you have with Pro Football Talk? Is it 100% owned by you, or is it a partnership with NBC Sports? Do they have an ownership stake, or do they own any of the content? How does that partnership and that relationship work between you and with NBC?
And it was very simple. When they approached us back in 2009, they wanted to do an exclusive license of the content. So that's what they've had since day one. we still own the equity in the website. And if there's ever a point in time where we disengage from NBC, then we just go back to being profootballtalk.com, which still works as the domain name. It flips over to profootballtalk.nbcsports.com immediately. But if that ever would end, and I have no desire for it to end, but if it ever would end, then we would just go back to being completely independent with no strings attached, no equity to buy back from NBC. And, you know, they never offered to buy the equity. They've never offered to buy the equity. And, you know, we're 10 years in now, and I don't see that changing anytime soon, if ever.
So there's really no indication that of anything with the relationship that it is now with NBC. Everything sounds really good. There really wouldn't be anything at the moment to entice you to go out on your own again?
I have no desire whatsoever to end the relationship with NBC. I mean, they have been great to me. It's worked out incredibly well for me, for my family. My career has grown in ways I never would have imagined. I acquired skills that I didn't know that I had 10 years ago, especially having a radio and TV show now that we do every weekday out of my house. You know, I have to travel every weekend during football season back and forth to Connecticut, but I'm able to live here year-round, and they've been great to me. I mean, I'm going to stay there as long as they want me, and hopefully that's as long as I'm either able to do this or, you know, alive to do it.
I know you talked about your relationship with NBC. You've worked with Al Michaels for many years now, and I still can't get over the fact that in his last book, he talked about this before that, but he's claimed at the age of 74 to have never eaten a vegetable in his life. And meanwhile, I'm 31 and I'm trying to get as much fruits and vegetables into my diet as possible so I don't get too fat now that I'm a new dad. But how much longer do you think Al Michaels wants to continue to be the voice of Sunday Night Football? Because he's 74, he's still going strong and he still sounds great. But I mean, you know the man awfully well. How much longer do you think he wants to do this?
Oh, I have no idea. And, you know, he's the best to have ever done it. He can do it as long as he wants from my perspective. And it is true. He's never eaten a vegetable. I've been around him at dinner, and he refuses to. He has always refused to. He continues to refuse to. And apparently, you know, maybe he's figured it out, and more of it should be shunning all vegetables because it's working well for him. And I can't envision Sunday Night Football without Al Michaels, and yeah, I hope he keeps doing it, you know, as long as he possibly can.
I'm probably focusing on the wrong thing, but I mean, you've probably sat down and had meals with him, like you just said. Like, so if he's having a steak, is it just the steak on the plate? There's no, like,
it's just the steak.
There's no, like, mashed potatoes or anything.
I think potatoes fall into the vegetable category.
That's what I thought.
That's
amazing. It's incredible.
Yeah.
But he's been able to survive it for this long and continue to sound great. You've also had the opportunity on PFT Live to talk to a lot of really smart people, a lot of really smart NFL analysts, and some that maybe haven't had the chance to get there yet. Have you thought about who the next untapped NFL analyst is that maybe we haven't begun to talk about yet?
Well, you know, that's a good question. And of course, anytime someone says that's a good question, that's just buying time so you can think. I don't carry around a little list like that because fortunately, I'm not in the business of having to, like, you know, look for people to hire very frequently because we have a very stable workforce, and NBC does all the hiring for the on-air stuff. So from my perspective, it's not something I have to do, so I don't think about it very much. So, and because I don't consume a lot of NFL content beyond games, I really don't know who's out there and who would be in a position where, you know, they're moving in the direction of, of prominence or potential or whatever the case may be. So you kind of stumped me on that one.
Well, let me follow up then and not necessarily ask you about who's next, but what do you typically look for from an NFL game analyst that stands out to you? Are you looking for somebody like Romo, who the last couple of years has really sort of has this exuberance and excitement about calling a game and tends to be a little bit more predictive, or your colleague Chris Collinsworth, who's really good at game plan and game design breakdown within the context of the game, or maybe it's a combination of both? What do you look for in a game analyst?
I really don't want the analyst to be predictive, for the same reason I don't want to know who the draft pick is before the commissioner tells me. I just want to watch it and enjoy it on every given play. And it's a tough balance. When you as an analyst are going down that path, it's a fine line, because you quickly look like you're showing off. And I know that there are some people who believe that from Romo's perspective, you know, he's at practice, he's in meetings. You know, it may not be just a reflection of his knowledge of the game. It may be that he's got inside information about what's coming. So part of it may be a little bit of a parlor trick. I know there are some people who think that, and I don't know enough about how any of that works to know with specificity whether or not he's doing it. But from my perspective, what I'd much rather have is somebody who can explain it, what happened, what we've seen, in a way that is very simple, understandable, and inclusive. That's why John Madden was so good. John Madden made it seem like it was easily understandable for anybody who was watching the game. And that's not easy to do, because it is a very complex and nuanced game. And if you can take that complexity and that nuance and turn it into something that can be very easily understood by anyone who's watching, that's critical. Because I think sometimes when you have analysts that get caught up in jargon and advanced concepts, it alienates the audience, and they end up enjoying it less than they could have.
I know you have a limited amount of time, so I do appreciate you joining us. Mike Florio is with us on the Awful Announcing podcast. It would certainly be a mistake to have you on and not ask you about the actual NFL itself. Obviously, people are talking about the upcoming labor potential dispute in 2021, so if I had you fill in the blank, the NFL and the Player Association agreed on blank to avoid a labor dispute in 2021. What do you think gets done?
You mean when? Or what?
What would they have to agree on to be able to avoid a labor dispute? What do you think would probably be the core issues on the table right now?
Well, I mean, the big thing is money. And, you know, that's always the key issue. Everything else is just detail. And there's two aspects to the money debate right now as it relates to the NFL and the NFLPA. One, how are they going to carve up the pie? The gross dollars that come through the cash register. Are they splitting it 47-53 like they currently do, with the players getting 47%? Does that number change? And added to that is the question of how much money the NFL is going to be allowed to take off the top for stadium credits, for construction and renovation of stadiums. Because I think one of the big issues this time around is that the NFL wants to take more off the top, which necessarily reduces the total take that the players get before they divide the money. So those to me are the two big issues, and tied up in one ball, it's money. And, you know, the NFL couches this as an extension. Well, if it's truly an extension, then just take the current deal, change the dates, and sign it again. And it's clearly not an extension. Both sides are going to want something different than what they currently have. So the question becomes, can they work that aspect of it out before we get to a point where there's either a lockout or a strike?
It might have been a couple weeks ago when the story broke that owners might be considering this 18-game schedule, but the players coinciding with being able to sit out two mandatory games so that they're only playing 16 games a season. Are the owners and players actually legitimately serious about this being something that goes on the table?
Well, the players have done a great job of taking the position that they want nothing beyond the current structure of the season, four preseason games and 16 regular season games, and they have developed the ultimate poker face on that point. And the NFL believes them. Now, I personally believe that at some point the NFL could make them an offer that they won't be able to refuse to do 18 games. But for now, yeah, it seems real that the players are not interested in changing the way things are. And I think the whole 18 with the 16 games per player limit, to me, ultimately, that's just a reflection of how badly the NFL wants 18, that they're willing to just think out loud on kooky ideas. And it's an idea that have been floating around for years, and we'd written about it and talked about it before. But it's funny, once it got out there, it got shot down so quickly, and I think people had such great analyses of the flaws in it that it's never going to be taken seriously by anyone. But to me, it just shows how serious the NFL is about taking the current structure and adding a 17th game or an 18th game.
Mike, I'm sure you can speak to the legal issues with what I'm about to say. So bear with me for a moment. I know it's not going to happen, but there's a part of me that just wishes that the NFL would be transparent with the fact that it's a dangerous sport and brain injuries can and will occur. But if they're willing to offer players the facts, and then if you as a player sign your contract, you're now fully aware of the medical data that's been published and concluded, I think there could be something positive with that. You know, I'd see football continuing to fade at the youth and the high school level. Maybe it starts to happen at the collegiate level if it's because it's being funded from an academic institution. I just don't think professional football is ever going away. Is there anything positive that can come from Roger Goodell in the NFL actually being willing to tell the truth and inform the players about the dangers of playing football without trying to hide behind this element of lack of conclusive information? Does that make any sense?
Well, it does. And let me tell you, every once in a while, somebody connected to the NFL will make statements suggesting that they don't view the problem as seriously as everyone else does. Although for the most part, I think the NFL has recognized that from a liability standpoint, from a business survival standpoint, they need to make the game safer. And I think they have made the game so much safer over the last 10 years than it was. I was watching not that long ago, and the game's available on YouTube, a playoff game between the Vikings and 49ers from 1987. That was a year of the strike, and the 49ers were still 13-2, and the Vikings were big underdogs, and Minnesota went out there and won the game. And I remember that one as a fan, because it was unthinkable that the Vikings could go to San Francisco and beat the 49ers in that game. And just watching the first drive of the game, Anthony Carter, who was about 5'10 and 130 pounds, all legs, he caught a pass, and he was fighting for a few extra yards, and a 49ers linebacker just blew him up helmet to helmet, drove him into the ground, and nobody said boo. And he got off, and he trotted back to the huddle, and you could see he was shaking the cobwebs out. Nobody said anything about it. And when you watch those old games, you see brutality like that all the time. And it's not there anymore. And so I think the NFL has done a great job of making the game safer. The question is, how safe can you possibly make the game? And, you know, will that continue to cause more parents to not let their kids play, even though kids play plenty of other sports that have the potential for head trauma, whether it's soccer, whether it's hockey. You know, Jay Glazer told me a story once, because he's involved with MMA, and he's got a gym out in L.A., and he had a mom come in a few years ago who wanted to get her kids signed up for MMA because she wanted something safer than football. And he said, are you kidding me? And if anybody's ever watched the UFC events, when a guy or a gal, when he's going the wrong way for them, they end up with maybe 6 or 7 concussions before the official jumps in to stop the fight. I mean, right. They just get destroyed. So, and nobody ever says boo about it. See, the NFL, I think, is a victim of two things. It's immense success, and second, all those years of denial, allowing themselves to become the focal point of that culture that was about doing everything possible to delay that day of reckoning when people realize that, yes, it's not good for you to ram your head into a wall repeatedly over and over again for the course of, you know, a 15-year NFL career.
Last thing I have for you, Mike, and I really do appreciate your time in joining us. Amongst all the different guests and people that you've had an opportunity to talk to, is there still sort of that white whale for you? Is there the one guest that you've been wanting to have a long conversation with? And who would that guest be, and what would you want to ask him?
Well, you know, the ultimate one for me so far was getting Tom Brady within a day or two or three after Super Bowl 51, the comeback for the ages. And I actually remember being nervous before that one, and I never get nervous anymore before interviewing somebody with that. But that one got me. And I think the only way that I would feel that way again is if I'd be able to sit down with Bill Belichick. Not that he would ever be interviewed by me. And he probably has no regard for the way I cover the NFL, because it's not nuts and bolts, X's and O's. It's all the human interest stuff and the drama and all the things that create distractions for football teams. So he'd probably never do it, but I would love to do it, just because it would be the closest thing to that feeling of when I had to stand up in court and deal with a judge that scared the crap out of me. He would be that judge that scares the crap out of me, and it would be interesting to see how I function in that setting. And I'm not sure I really want to. That's the thing. That's what makes it the perfect interview, because if all of a sudden he would say, yes, I'll do it, I'd be like, do I really want to do this? And so that's probably the one that I'll never get that would be fun to get.
Mike, thanks for joining us. I enjoy your work tremendously. I've been a longtime follower of yours, and I appreciate you making some time for us today. Thank you so much.
All right, appreciate it. Good talking to you.